Lecture 4, Bhagavad Gita.
We come now to the fourth of our lectures in our course on books that have made history, books that can change your life. We move now from the classical world of Greece and from the Empire of Rome to the classical civilization of India and to the magnificent poem, the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of God. But it's also time to reflect a bit on what we've learned so far. In our first lecture, we examined the concept of a great book. I said it was not a list of books that every educated person should read, but rather books that can speak to each one of us individually, and yet at the same time, books and authors that have made history, that have lived long past their time and can continue to shape and influence our lives and even the events that are the subject of such great books. We defined a great book as having a great theme, as being written in noble language and able to speak across the ages. And we decided that we would develop our course around the eternal theme that I believe every person, consciously or even unconsciously, must deal with. Themes of God, the theme of fate, good and evil, and thus the meaning of life and how we live our lives. In pursuit of truth, or do we even believe that truth exists? In terms of duty and responsibility, of law and justice and government, of love, of courage and honor and ambition, the theme of beauty and how do we relate to nature, and ultimately, what do we mean by education and how do these great books educate us? We saw in the figure of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a man who, in the pursuit of truth and good and evil, to find out what was true and to resist with courage the evil of Hitler's Third Reich, gave his life, a philosopher, like Socrates. It was thought that one could crush these ideas in the dank cell of a prison. Yet his book, his letters and papers from prison, lived on and spoke to an entirely new generation in America in the civil rights movement of the 1960s. In the same way, the Iliad, the subject of our second great book, speaks across the ages to continue to give us wisdom in such central themes as God and fate, the meaning of good and evil, but perhaps above all, of how to live your life with courage and yet at the same time understand nothing in excess. The Iliad is the first great work of literature to come down from classical Greece. And with Marcus Aurelius in our third lecture, we saw the summation of Greek thought upon the matters of God, fate, good and evil. Marcus Aurelius wrote in Greek. He had studied Greek philosophy, and we must understand that the Roman Empire of the 1st and 2nd centuries AD, that immense majesty of the Roman Empire that I described, stretching over such a vast part of the world and bringing prosperity to it, was culturally the heir of Greece. Greek was an official language along with Latin. Those who ruled this empire, like a Marcus Aurelius, had been schooled in the literature of Greece, and Roman writers such as Virgil looked upon the Greek models, such as Homer, as models so great that they could be emulated, but never surpassed. In that sense, the Roman Empire bears comparison to our own. We saw that Rome is the only superpower in history, except for our own. It is the only empire to have been absolutely dominant militarily, economically, politically, and culturally until our own day in America. And in the same way as the Romans were the heirs of the Greeks, so we are the heirs of European civilization. America is a multicultural land, and many, many civilizations have added to our richness. But ultimately, our culture goes back to Europe, and later generations will see us as the heirs to European civilization, as the Romans, like Marcus Aurelius, were the heirs of Greek thought. And Marcus, brought to a culmination that transformation of God in the poetry of Homer, Zeus, from being a capricious and lecherous master, constantly seducing women, afraid of his wife, beating his own children, into being absolute truth and good, equated with nature, all-powerful, all-knowing, all-seeing. We see that same culmination of an image of God into a vision of truth occurring in the world of classical India, perhaps as early as 500 BC, in the form of the magnificent poem, the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of God. The great Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, the man who, by his belief in truth, by his courage, brought to its knees the mighty empire of Britain and led his land, India, to independence. Gandhi, this man of courage and of profound religious belief, called the Bhagavad Gita the religious work par excellence. And every day, in fact, while he was brushing his teeth, he would read portions of the Bhagavad Gita to give him courage for the struggle for life. What is the Bhagavad Gita? What is the civilization that produced this religious work par excellence? India has a civilization as rich and multifaceted as classical Greece. Already at the time of the civilizations of Mesopotamia, let us say around 2000 BC, time also of Egypt, when the pyramids were already 500 years old, India saw a flourishing civilization along the Indus River. The great city of Taxila is still a monument in its archaeological remains to this splendid civilization, which was around 1800, perhaps, overrun by invaders from the west. They gave themselves the name Aryan, meaning noble in their language. Their language itself was closely related to Persian, more distantly related to Greek, to Latin, and indeed to the languages of the Germanic world and even to the languages of the Slavic world. They imposed their rule upon India by conquest. And out of warfare and destruction came a flourishing new civilization that produced a rich poetry in epic form, rivaling that of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And part of that epic tradition was the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of God. The religion of the classical civilization of India, this civilization called Aryan, the noble civilization, and we must not allow that word to be discredited by the misuse under the Nazis and others. But this civilization of the language of Sanskrit, which would give ultimately be the ancestor of, for example, the Hindi language of today, the religion of this society was Hinduism. It is still a living faith. There are some 600 million Hindus. It is a polytheistic religion, like that of classical Greece. It is a religion that does not believe that the world is of the gods is finite. The polytheist, whether a Hindu or whether an ancient Greek, is always willing to admit new divinities, to recognize a new divine power, a power capable of rendering supernatural benefits to the community. It is the same religion that we see among our Native Americans. A rock rolls down from a cliff, causing destruction. Well, something in that rock is a divine power, and it is set aside, it is revered, it is worshipped as a power capable of doing good things or evil things. This is a deeply spiritual view of the world in which all of nature can be a manifestation of the divine. The thunder, the lightning, the rain, and sacrifice is fundamental to this worship, to offer up homage to the gods in return for the good things that they have blessed us with, or to avert evil things that might destroy us. And in the richness of the Hindu religion, gods could take many forms, as they could in ancient Egypt. They could be monkey gods, elephant gods, all of these manifestation of the power of the divine and its ability to work through the world and control the entire universe. And as in Greece, as in Homer, or as in Marcus Aurelius, this polytheistic notion of the divine could lead to an image of one God, a universal, all-powerful God, and a spiritual richness. That is the message of the Bhagavad Gita. The poem itself is part of a much larger epic, the Mahabharata. And the Bhagavad Gita is a small poem, rightly compared to a shrine within a great cathedral of wisdom. It takes place as part of an epic story of warfare, just as the Iliad is a story of warfare. But as Homer understood, and as the author anonymous to us, we do not know who composed the Bhagavad Gita. As the author of Bhagavad Gita also understood, war is but a symbol for the ongoing conflict of life, the struggle for life, and the struggle for wisdom to lead that life in a way that is meaningful to us as individuals. It is a struggle between two great warring tribes of the Indians, and also a struggle between right and wrong, between good and evil. But the hero of the story, Arjuna, does not understand this at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. He must fight against his own kinsmen, and he is weary and worn out and wants to throw away his bow. When his charioteer, Krishna, speaks to him, the very first word of this poem, the Bhagavad Gita, is truth, dharma, truth's battlefield. This is what happens on the battlefield of life, on the battlefield of truth. And Krishna is the charioteer of Arjuna, but he is also the image of the supreme God of the universe. And Arjuna is every man, every woman. He is the soul. And Krishna is his charioteer. And Krishna must explain in these verses of wisdom whither the soul goest. And the first word is truth. And if we want our central theme of the Bhagavad Gita, it is truth. It is a poem about truth. For as the great Gandhi said, it is more important to believe that truth is God than that God is truth. It is truth that comes first. Be steadfast in the truth. And that is the message of Krishna to Arjuna. Be steadfast in the truth. And fight the battle of life, understanding what truth is. For truth is God. And the poem of the Bhagavad Gita is to explain to Arjuna and explain to every man and woman that behind the constantly changing formations of the divine, behind all that passes to and fro in the world, there is one enduring divine being who is all. Krishna is a manifestation of this one supreme divine being. He is God, and God is everywhere and in all things, permeating the universe. And at a splendid moment in the poem, this God makes himself visible to Arjuna. In his grace, he shows Arjuna his true form. And the vision is all but too powerful for Arjuna to envision with his eyes. It almost overwhelms him, of a God who is everywhere and everything, infinite mind, infinite arms, infinite legs, infinite teeth, everything. And the universe itself, the whole of it, is contained in just an atom of this divine being, so powerful, so infinite, so beyond our powers of imagination. That is the God who is everything. And in every person, there is the particle of this divine being. That is the God within you. The Atman, the Spirit, the God within you. And that is divine. So having had a glimpse of the majesty of God, coming to understand that God is all and everything, then we come to our understanding of what is our role in the universe that God has created. And that role is our soul. Marcus Aurelius wasn't sure that a soul existed, and if it did, it came to an end. Not so for the Bhagavad Gita. For Homer and the Iliad, the soul is a winged creature that goes down to a pitiful little existence in the underworld. Remember how Achilles would later tell Odysseus that it is better to be a slave in the world above, working land for someone else, than to be king of the underworld. It is a pitiful existence. For Homer, this life is what we have and we must live it. So too for Marcus Aurelius. Not so for the Bhagavad Gita. The soul is what endures. And this life, why, it is just a tiny second in the universe. We come into being, we go away in our bodily form. It is the soul that endures. So that is the next step. To understand that your soul is eternal. It is divine within you. And your task thus becomes to purify that soul, to gain the wisdom and the truth, so that your soul can gain ultimate liberation. That's our next step. For the body, you see, is a prison. It encloses you just as much as the prison cell at Flossenbürg and prison Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The body encloses you. And what encloses you within the body are all the desires that come from the body, all of which are the result of false knowledge, of false wisdom. They are desires. Desires for power, desires for wealth, desires for love. Love of earthly goods and earthly creatures. All of which are just delusions. But they imprison you. So you must, through wisdom, begin to shed yourself of these false desires. And the first step on that is understanding, is gaining true knowledge. So having grasped the fact that God is all, that our soul is eternal, then we understand that the world itself is bondage for us. And the path of wisdom is to lead you to a stage where you are freed for eternity from this bondage that is the soul. But it is no easy task, let me tell you. First, there are the false perceptions of the world that you must have power. Well, people of power and their lust lead not to any kind of liberation ultimately, but when they die, they just pass back into some other creature. And indeed, if in order to maintain their power, they have followed Machiavelli and done many terrible things, they will come back into a terrible existence. Why, you might come back as a cockroach, a dung beetle, forever pushing foul filth up and down a hill until you liberate your body is liberated and passed into some other evil. Because the fate that you lay upon yourself by your choices in this life endure far beyond the next or the next or the next. They may go on for generation after generation after generation of your suffering for the choices that you made in this life. Ultimately, the Bhagavad Gita is about choice. About making the right choices through wisdom. Now, sin plays an important role in the Bhagavad Gita. And earthly actions are good or evil, and they have enduring consequences. You make a choice now to lust or to have power or to do wrong. Then that choice will determine generations to come of suffering for you. Or you can make the choice of wisdom. Wisdom. And it is by following wisdom that you gain, ultimately, eternal liberation. What is that wisdom? Wisdom is understanding karma. K-A-R-M-A. It's a word we hear a whole lot and had a great deal of currency in the 1960s. But karma is basic to the message of the Bhagavad Gita. And karma means work or task. Karma is the task that you have been assigned by God. It is your role and your job in this small, tiny particle of the universe that is you.
And this choice to accept your karma is not a resignation. It's not saying, oh, well, this is what I have to do. No, it must be made with a full realization of the difficulty of the task of doing your duty. So Krishna comes back to Arjuna and he says, your duty is to fight this war. It is not to renounce. The man or the woman who renounces his task is doomed to eternal reincarnation and suffering. Or you can accept your task but out of fear and do it with a half heart. That too is no way of liberation, but instead back to the eternal reoccurrence of birth and birth and birth. Or you can do that task with your whole heart. Do it well and you might rise a step or two. You might come back as a wise person. Or do it with supreme spirit, with the full dutifulness of your conscience and your understanding. Fight this war of life on the battlefield of truth, Arjuna. And that is the way to ultimate liberation and to unification with God, to moving into the soul of God and never again to come back to earth, to have the pure bliss of unification with God. That is ultimate freedom and ultimate liberation. I can tell you about the way to freedom, but you must choose it, Arjuna, here on the battlefield of life. And if you do that task with all your will, it doesn't matter if you sin in the course of life. You may do many wrong actions. But that ultimate decision to follow your way will be like a canoe that brings you across the great sea of life to ultimate liberation. Even the greatest sinner can be liberated by doing his or her task to the utmost. So, the religion of the Bhagavad Gita is in no way a renunciation of life. It is a call to the ultimate meaning of life and to struggle. It is a call to follow our themes when we ask ourselves, how should we live? We have answered the question of God in the Bhagavad Gita. God is all, eternal, everlasting, pervading the whole of the universe. Good and evil and fate, yes, there is a good, and it is to follow your mission in life. And fate, every individual, every particle of the universe has its destiny, its task set before it. Accept it. Do not rail against it. Do not kick against it. Accept it. But first, of course, you must have the wisdom to know it, to understand it. And in that you find the meaning of your life. In that you understand that truth is everything in all things. And in it, you find that true sense of duty and responsibility. And it may be a sense of duty and responsibility that leads you away from your family. It may lead you away from what others tell you to be your duty. For God has given you your duties, not men and women, not society. And government and justice, why ultimate justice lies in every particle of the universe fulfilling willingly, joyfully, the will of God. Because you see, the Bhagavad Gita does not separate as we do the things of Caesar from the things of the world. The world, God, fate, life, government, war, they are all mingled together. And it provides a total vision of the world and of justice. It was this vision that made it so difficult for Winston Churchill to understand Gandhi. To Churchill, Gandhi was a faker of the worst sort, wrapping himself up in a loincloth, striding up the steps of the Viceregal Palace in New Delhi, preaching a gospel of love thy neighbor, where in fact he was waging the most insidious warfare against the greatest empire in the world that brought liberty under law to millions. Churchill, as much as I admire him, was an absolute European in his look and could not understand this deep vision that we find in the Bhagavad Gita. that justice is part of the divine order, and that the man of justice carries out his struggle steadfast in the truth and unshakable, and that justice is not of men, but of the divine world. So a sense of government resting in God. And love? Why, the Bhagavad Gita is all about the love of God. The love that led Krishna to take form in this world by his own graciousness, that Arjuna could see him. And your love? It is due entirely to God, to becoming absolutely immersed in the divine. And to do that, you may forsake all things and put yourself steadfast on this path. It is a central message of the Bhagavad Gita that God has created many roads to the truth. This is my road, Arjuna would say. You must find your own road. And there are those who will find their road, the Bhagavad Gita tells us, in carrying out sacrifice, that is to say, earthly sacrifices, in great religious piety, devoting themselves to traditional religion. And there are those who will find their path by constant study and contemplation and meditation. But my path, the path that God has set for me, Arjuna says, is in constant struggle and strife. And that is what Gandhi came to understand, that his path had been set to struggle for the liberation of his country. Contemplation, religious piety, struggle in this world, all of these are roads to God. And that is why the Hindu never seeks to define absolutely the world of the gods. There are many different forms of God, and each one may have a role in leading one individual to an understanding of the truth. It is not the form of God. It is not the ceremonies of God that you choose. It is a recognition that God is truth. And with that comes the courage to live your life, to follow your karma. That is your ambition. That is true ambition, and that is true honor, to follow the way of God. And that leads you to an understanding of beauty. The European mind may find much that is strange with the temples of India, with the strange-looking divinities, even as we find much strange in the Egyptian worship of a jackal god, for example. Well, that is a narrow outlook. God is everywhere in nature, and every creation of nature is beautiful in its own way. And beauty? Beauty is in the eyes of the beholder that God manifests himself to. And education? Well, the Bhagavad Gita joins the Divine Comedy as one of the great works on education ever written, ever composed, to lead you from the darkness and night of a life without meaning to the clear, bright sunshine, the blinding light of God's wisdom. Dante could not have known the Bhagavad Gita. And yet in his description of God making his presence known to Dante and showing him that vision of divine glory, the two works in Sanskrit and in Italian absolutely merge. I must turn away my eyes, Dante said, from that vision of glory, as Arjuna is equally blinded. Now certainly there were contacts between classical Greece and classical India. And the story of the transmigration of souls, this doctrine appears in Pythagoras at roughly the same time as the Bhagavad Gita. And the evolutionary-minded historian might say, well, possibly through trade routes, there was connections between India and Greece. And out of this grew an idea of transmigration of souls in Greece. And nonsense, I think. At least this is what the Bhagavad Gita would say. The Bhagavad Gita believed that this whole historical approach was folly. Indeed, classical Indian civilization has little regard for history, this concrete knowledge of the past. The first absolute date in the history of India is given to it by the West when Alexander invades it in 327 BC. No, the Bhagavad Gita would say that the similarities between this vision of God and Dante's Divine Comedy are the vision of the soul as we shall find it in Plato's Phaedo of Socrates and in the Bhagavad Gita. It's a sapientia perennis, an eternal, enduring wisdom, deeper than any history, deeper than the mind of man. Well, that's a thesis we might pursue as we continue our look into books that have made history, books that can change your life.